what this Bible study, I really haven't found a good title for it. It's really out of the Behind the Bible series. And it's not really looking at the content as much as the form and the history of the book itself. And in a certain way, it's bringing up a question that many, many people have worked very hard for us to settle. The fact that we have now a reliable, many, many reliable translations in English, and dozens of them in English, is the work of people who have gone into questions that have gone into very tricky and troublesome questions, so that we wouldn't have to, so that we could just have this and read and make all sorts of assumptions about its accuracy and about its authority.
This is a Bible you're holding up.
Yeah.
Here.
Okay. Okay. Right. It's the Revised Standard Version. So I do with a little hesitation bring up some of the issues that they have faced, and hopefully my purpose in doing that is to first of all bring an appreciation to you of the work that has been done. Second of all, to maybe to help eliminate some assumptions we make about the Bible that in some ways can be destructive. Assumptions about identifying the words in here with the Word of God, the idea that this is not a historically conditioned book, that it is a bunch of oracles that have no relation or can speak independent of the history through which they have passed. And hopefully by doing that, there will become some theological issues will be raised up and exposed that are probably crucial for our everyday kind of faith. I'll just run through my outline here. First thing we'll talk about today is the occasion of writing the scripture and kind of how what we have, the earliest sources of what we have in our Old and New Testament, became written documents and kind of the reason why. The second part is there were many, many more books written than are included in our Bible. And some Bibles of different churches have different things in them. And we're going to look at a little bit of that process. The third is kind of the family tree of the American or the English editions of the Bible. How Bibles came from one edition to another and how we finally end up with what we have. And then the fourth part is, so what? And hopefully you'll be able to have some input on that and be able to tell me if the information has been helpful. And I will give you some of the things that I find, the kind of conclusions that I've been able to draw from and the way it's helped me. Okay, the first part, the occasion of writing scripture. How did it get written? How did what we have in the Bible, all these, the stories of Abraham, the stories of King David, the stories of Jesus and of Paul, how did they come to be written down? Okay, and to do this, I have to do a little bit of a timeline here, okay? We'll start back here at 1800 B.C., before Christ, or the international way to say that now is before the Common Era, which is an acceptable way to term it for Christians and Jews both. We'll put another date right around here, 1000 B.C.E., 500 B.C.E., we'll put zero here, and then like 100 of the Common Era, which is the same as A.D. here. All right, the events that are talked about in the Old Testament begin back here with Abraham and Sarah. Stories are told. And the important thing to realize is that what's going on here can be described best in these two words. There's a story about a relationship between God and people, and the relationship is described in particular concrete events, not a kind of a continuum of history, but certain decisive events. And that the events that occur here are etched in the memory of this people. What happens, I'll just give you a brief sketch of this history. Moses, the Exodus, Mount Sinai, down around 1000 AD, King David, after coming into Canaan, the promised land out of Egypt, and down here, the kingdom, and all the kings of Israel and Judah that followed. And at this point, the memories are involved in all sorts of different, occur in all sorts of different forms. There is the hymn book of Israel that we have, that's included in our book of the Psalms. All the songs you sung at the temple, they go all the way back to David's time. The stories of Abraham and Sarah, of course, go back, are the memories of the descendant people. But at this point, we don't have anything that resembles what we have in our Old Testament. They're all in different sorts of forms. A lot of it is just oral tradition memory, the kind of thing that you can teach orally people. At this point, there's the exile. The kingdom is destroyed. And this is probably the event, in the crucial event that gave rise to the writing of all this memory events. And what happened here was that writing began at a furious pace, because the question was, how can we make sense of this experience? God chose us as God's people, and it ended at the exile. Did God abandon us? Were we just too sinful? Are the gods of Babylon stronger? There were theological problems with that experience that were so immense that it called for nothing short of going back over the entire memory and starting to put it in order. So the writing began. He had what was called the Deuteronomic history, which is like Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings, the story of this period here, trying to figure out why it was that this destruction happened. So, and it's called the Deuteronomic history because the book of Deuteronomy gave the principle of interpretation. Because you didn't love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, you love your neighbor as yourself, because you didn't follow in the way, that is why the exile happened. There were others. There were priests that wrote stories, and it was because they said, it's because we didn't keep the laws tight enough. There were people that talked about blood purity. They said, well, it's because we allowed intermarriage. And so there was a big concern with genealogies and keeping, and all this stuff got put together in the stories that were written.
Are there representatives of all of those things in the Bible?
Yes, yes. And one of the conclusions you draw from this is that the Bible is a struggle with the memory. That it's trying to make sense out of this particular history. Okay? And it was at this point when the writing began here, all the sorts of crucial events and the unanimity that they had about, that the people had about the Exodus, about King David, about Abraham and Sarah and the promises there, started to disappear and fragment. And there was no longer any consensus in Israel. And so the putting down of the books became real important. The form it took was the first five books, which were the earliest stories here, became what was called the Torah, the law. Very authoritative for the people around this particular time. We're dealing with people now back in Judea, subject to first the Hellenistic rulers and then the Roman rulers, struggling. Why aren't these promises happening? Along with the law, which covers the earliest memory, comes the experience of the prophets, and we'll talk a little bit about how the Jews divided up their Bible, because it isn't at all like ours. And then what were called the writings. So when Jesus, at this particular time, talks about the law and the prophets, he's speaking about the particular divisions of the Hebrew writings of their memory. The things that are known as the writings are things like the books of poetry, the Psalms, the Proverbs, Job, books of Esther, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, and then some of the later writings are even Daniel and Ruth, the Chronicles. And so I guess in summary, the writing began as a struggle with the memory. it was the event of the exile and the hope of the return that brought about this struggle. And that when it came down to the life of Jesus, the struggle and the debate about the meaning of the memory was really going on hot and heavy. All right. Any questions on that? It's kind of a real quick trip through the Old Testament. All right, out of this tradition comes the man Jesus. And from this experience come very quickly, from the life of Jesus, death and resurrection, come the Christian writings. And they all come really quickly, probably within 50 years of each other, all the New Testament books we have. So it's very different than here. They're a little bit different character, because the event of Jesus' life was so powerful that there was no need for any sort of written stories. And Luther said it best. He said the New Testament should never have been written down. It's meant to be preached. The minute it gets put into words, you have the danger of it becoming just rote, and it loses its power. There is something like that going on at the time of Jesus, that the experience of the crucified and risen Lord for the disciples was the reality. They didn't need a book. And so the scriptures for the first church, the apostolic church, was, of course, all these writings. These impinged this. And actually, I guess the arrow would go the other way, that Jesus, the experience of the crucified and risen Jesus, explained this. And they had a very radically different attitude toward the Hebrew scriptures than other Hebrews did. The sacredness of the book was violated, in that the events, the very fresh events, had it, were the things that interpreted the law, the prophets, and the writings. It was only later, as the first generation began to get old and die, that the immediate return of Jesus didn't materialize like they had hoped, that they saw that the memory would have to be preserved in some way, that these things, the necessity of writing down the records, came to be. Now, nobody, in either the Old Testament, in the collection of Old Testament writers or the New Testament writers, ever thought that 2,000 years later, we would be standing here with this book of holy writings. There was a certain amount of character similar to that with the law, with the first five books, the Torah, at the time of Jesus. But the New Testament writers and the people who wrote the histories were struggling with their memory. They weren't writing oracles. Okay, now that changes things a little bit, doesn't it?
Struggling with their memory, they couldn't remember everything exactly.
They were trying to understand what it meant. If the promise to Abraham and Sarah was that they would be, through them all the nations would bless themselves and they would become a nation as numerous as the grains of sand on the beach, why were they a small subject province under the Romans? And that was the struggle. The promise doesn't seem to relate or correspond to the reality. Okay?
Is that a similar sort of thing happening in the New Testament? They're struggling with Jesus in the light of persecution afterwards, or you know, that he has not returned. And so they're not just recording the events, but they're doing the same kind of wrestling that you've talked about in the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's a good point. That there were all sorts of people with different interpretations of Jesus that came along, and one of the reasons for writing down was to say no to this particular idea and yes to this other one. There's evidence that the Gospel of John was written not only to tell about Jesus, but also to say things to Gnostic Christians, or Christians that had this dualism, the mind and the body was evil, the mind was good, to say to them that Gnostic Christianity was a heresy. You say that, no, that's not right. This is right. And so it was in reaction sometimes to false belief, and also to the expectations that the church had about Jesus coming quickly again. And as that dragged out, they began to reassess what he had said. And and write things down. A third thing would be, I forgot what I was going to say. Okay, so both are characterized by a struggle and not this easy Holy Spirit in the ear out onto the paper. Okay, not to say that that isn't involved somehow, but we have to account for the human situation that gave rise to this energy to write. Okay. Just want to mention a few things about how some of the evidence about how the writing took place. You can find right in the Bible itself. In Jeremiah 36, I'll just read. You don't have to look these up. The fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Take a scroll and write on it all the words that I have spoken to you against Israel and Judah and the nation. So Jeremiah dictated to Baruch, his secretary, and Baruch wrote on the scroll. This is one of the very few references in the Old Testament of anyone doing any kind of writing. The purpose of this was that it not be kept in a library and become part of our Bible, but that it be taken to the king and read to the king, who right at that moment was being rebellious against Babylon and was just a few years before the extinction of the nation of Israel. The purpose was a very immediate, concrete, historical one. And when Baruch took and read it to the king's cabinet, they got all upset, took it to the king and read it. And the king, as each column was read, would cut it off and throw it in the fire. And then he'd ask the reader to continue. He'd cut off another section and throw it in the fire. And then Baruch had to write the whole thing over again. And Jeremiah then put it away for safekeeping. There are books mentioned in the Chronicles and books mentioned in the other historical writings that we don't have any idea what happened to, like the book of Joshua that's mentioned in 1 Samuel, the book, the commentary on the book of the Kings, the Chronicles of Samuel the seer, the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet. These are all books mentioned in Chronicles. No one knows what's happened to them, and one can imagine that somehow there may have been a royal library during the kingdom and was destroyed during various invasions, and that the writing here may have done with some of those, been done with some of those sources, could have been done from memory. The New Testament began, of course, Paul, the earliest are Paul's letters. Paul was not writing books of the Bible. He's writing letters to churches in trouble. And the church has saved those not because they saw in Paul an intent to make scripture, but that they were very practical and the kind of wisdom one looked for and expected from a leader of the church, and through that, the wisdom of God in establishing the community of believers. Let's see if I have any more on this first section here. One last point is that all of this, the writing of the earliest of scriptures took time. It took usage. It took concrete situations to bring it about. It took thinking. It took agreement. It took a lot of disagreement, too. You'll find the books in the Old Testament and some in the New are speaking at very different situations and read side by side, seem to be debating or conversing with one another. And it took editing and collecting to get the kind of scriptures that we end up calling our Bible today. And we say that these writings are crucial to our faith. Not because it's some magic book, but because it is the means by which we engage in dialogue with our ancestors and through them with the concrete actions of the one we call our Lord. The second part, we've talked a little bit about the situation that gave rise to the original writings. The next thing is, once the writings were written, it became a problem which writings had the kind of character that best reflected and best explained and best brought to the people the idea of the covenant God, the wisdom and the instructions of God, and the admonition to be God's people. Which ones best reflected God's relationship to God's people? And the question was, which books, which writings do it? And by saying that, I have to say there are many, many, many more writings than we have included in our book. Many of much the same character. Many that are titled and intended to be the same sorts of books. In the Old Testament, the historical writings continue on right after the exile. Stories about the Maccabean Revolution, stories that, as far as their events go, fit right into the end of our historical Bible, the histories of the Bible, but for some reason are not included. In the New Testament, there are epistles from like 3 Corinthians. There are 4th and 5th letters from that have Peter's name on them. There's the Gospel of Thomas. There's the Gospel of the Apostles. Let's see, there's a couple others that... there are other stories about Daniel. There's the letter to the Laodiceans in the New Testament. There's the Gospel of the Hebrews, Gospel of the Nazarenes. The question is, which books are the ones that speak most directly to our faith, and which ones do the people of God decide are authoritative for them? And giving a little bit of indication, it wasn't easy. Christians had an easy time of it with the Old Testament. I'll just give you a little idea. By the time of Jesus, the Hebrew writings were pretty well established. I'll give you a list of them. There was the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The Jews felt that those were the most authoritative books. The second level of authoritative books were the former prophets, which were Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, who were historical books. The latter prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the Book of the 12. And then the writings came. And at the time of Jesus, there was some debate about which writings were included. And essentially, with the exception of Esther, which people couldn't really make up their mind about, whether you'd include that or not, all the books that we have today in our modern RSV were part of the Hebrew canon. But the writing didn't stop. There were stories about later events, and these were called apocryphal books. That's what we call them now. But there are the stories about the Maccabees. There's a story about Tobit, which was a story about a man that was carried off to Assyria during the fall of the Northern Kingdom and lived sort of, it's kind of an Arabian Nights tale. And there's story of Susanna, who in Babylon, I think she's very beautiful, and two lecherous old men decide that they would like to have intercourse with her. They stay in her garden where she's taking her bath, and when her maid goes in, they rush out to her and plead with her, and she says no. Well, they get angry and accuse her in a court, and she's going to be stoned, and then they bring her before Daniel, and Daniel asks the perceptive questions and finds out the two men were lying, and they get stoned. In most editions of the RSV, or these fat editions of English Bibles, they have what is called the Apocrypha, and most of these are literature that are written in between the end of the writing of the Old Testament, which was around 300 B.C., and the beginning of the New Testament. So right around the intertestamental period are the stories that are called the Apocrypha. And it was decided by Jews in Palestine around 90 A.D., that they would exclude these. And they established pretty much once and for all what was included in the Hebrew Bible, and that's essentially what we have today. It's a little more complicated than that, though, because there are many Hebrews in Egypt. And they translated the Hebrew Bible, or the Hebrew writings, into Greek, because that's what they spoke down in Egypt at that time. And the legend has it that they gave the Hebrew Bible to 70 Jewish elders in Alexandria, and they all went into their own little rooms and translated it. And at the end of 70 days, 72 days, all 72 of them came back in, and their translations were all identical. And so they said, God must have decided that this is the authoritative book. It's called the Septuagint. It's represented by LXX, the Roman numerals for 70. Septuagint just means in Greek 70. And it's reference to that, the story, the legend of its origin. Now they were quite a bit, time has proven that they were quite a bit sloppier about the translation than they like to believe. They also included apocryphal books left and right, and the Jewish community down there developed a really expanded version of the Hebrew Bible with all these intertestamental stories. It wasn't until 1000 that the Jews finally got together and said, they resurrected Hebrew as the language of the people, as the scholarly language, and said finally no to the books, the extra books that were in here, and established once and for all, for modern times, what the Hebrew canon was, the Hebrew scripture. And these people were known as the Masoretes. They were scholars, Hebrew scholars in the Middle Ages, and I don't know a whole lot about them. Very mysterious sort of sounding name. The Christians made this the basis of their Old Testament. Okay? They didn't go to the Hebrew Bible, they took the Septuagint. And their New Testament was written in Greek. Most, probably all the books were in their original language were Greek. And the Christians, because I think they had kind of a little bit more flexible attitude about the Hebrew Bible, because the Old Testament was just a testimony to Jesus. It was in some ways different than the experience and the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. They were able to adopt this, and they pulled in with it the apocryphal books and found them to be as instructive as other. So what happened was that the Old Testament took two very different tracks in the development with the Hebrew usage, or with the Jewish usage, and the Christian usage. And what happened was it wasn't until the Reformation that the Christian church finally, at least the Protestant churches, finally decided that the apocryphal books here were not to be included in the Christian Bible. The Catholic Church still includes it because their descent, they weren't as affected by the kind of canonical or the revolution in studying the Bible that the Protestants were. Well, I'll expand on this chart a little bit later. I read a little bit this morning from the Gospel of Thomas. I want to talk a little bit about what came to be the apocryphal or the Christian writings outside the New Testament. These Christian writings all occurred in the first century, before the year 100 probably. What are known as the other writings were all later. And there's quite a bit of unanimity among the people that lived at that time that they were kind of extra, they were spurious, and didn't belong, weren't of the same quality as the Christian writings of the first century. And I just want to read a little bit out of the Gospel of Thomas again to give you an idea of what this second century gospel, some of the things it says. Some of the stories about Jesus, just to be fair to it, are very similar. But some of them are just really odd. I will read you a couple here. Jesus said, "The kingdom is like a shepherd who had 100 sheep. One of them went astray. It was the largest. He left the 99 and sought for the one until he found it. After he had exerted himself, he said to the sheep, 'I love you more than the 99. Here's another one, verse 97. The kingdom, Jesus said, the kingdom is like a woman who was carrying a jar full of meal. When she was walking along the way, the handle of the jar broke, and the meal spilled out behind her on the road. She did not know it. She did not perceive the accident. After she came into her house, she put the jar down and found it empty. This is an interesting one, verse 77. Jesus said, I am the light which is over everything. I am the all. The all came forth from me, and the all has reached to me. Split the wood, I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me there. You sense there's a little bit different character than the gospel we're used to hearing?
What kind of Bible is that?
Well, this is the Gospel of Thomas. It was a second century story of Jesus. And there are a dozen or so that the church, in its wisdom, has said, no, this is not what Jesus taught. To be fair, I should read some of the closer parallels. Jesus said, is it impossible for a man to ride two horses and to stretch two bows? And it is impossible for a servant to serve two masters. Either he will honor the one and despise the other. No one drinks old wine and immediately desires to drink new wine. And new wine is not put in old wineskins lest they burst. And old wine is not put into a new wineskin lest it spoil it. No one sews an old patch on a new garment because a rip will result. Very close in some parallels. I'll read the last verse here. It's enraging, but it also, I think, may be a testimony to the wisdom of the church fathers and mothers that struggled with what books reflected the teachings of Jesus and the apostles. Simon Peter said to them, let Mary go away from us, for women are not worthy of life. Jesus said, lo, I shall lead her so that I may make her a male, that she too may become a living spirit, resembling you males, for every woman who makes herself a male will enter the kingdom of heaven. The gospel according to Thomas.
I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of ties in with another verse.
Well, I can recommend this to you. It's very interesting reading. The point of reading it is to show that there is that although there are many, many difficulties in reading the New Testament, after having read some of the Gospel of Thomas, one begins to sense that there is a little more unanimity in what the New Testament scriptures we have say, and that there would be some terrible problems in our understanding of the Gospel were these to be included, and that the first two or three centuries of the church's existence is marked by terrible struggles over what were to be included in the Bible and what were not.
This is certainly back, but do we know, or do scholars know, or have strong conjectures about one, why the Septuagint was chosen rather than the old Hebrew Bible? You said that they were more flexible. Is it maybe because it was more inclusive, or it was written in Greek? And the other, why were the, especially since it's associated with Egypt, where I didn't particularly think of the early churches in it, and also why the early Greek, Christian writings were written in Greek, why that was the language of the early gospel writing.
Okay.
Or is that a diversion?
That's the third part we'll move to now, and unless there are any more questions about the canon, I don't have a lot of information on other books, and I'll have to work on that.
As a child, and it might have been an anti-Catholic prejudice, but I was told that one reason the Catholics kept the apocryphal was it affirmed some of the doctrines that were in the like purgatory.
Okay, that's probably the doctrines probably developed from the apocryphal writings. The idea of purgatory. A lot of the writings were apocalyptic writing, sort of this fantastic allegorizing of things, and that once the church began to draw doctrines from them to maintain them as scripture became important, because the foundation for some of the beliefs about purgatory would disappear, eliminated. I think the answer to that question is that, well, let me start on this third part. This, I have a rather complicated chart to draw up here. But down here, I'm just going to draw a column that talks about, we'll just label this, the Hebrew writings. And over here, the Greek Christian writings. Okay. We'll make a column here. Of course, these would begin a little bit later, say like down here. Let me just trace for an instant the Hebrew writings. Hebrew began to decline as a language before Jesus. And what happened when Alexander the Great rode through about 300 years before Jesus, everything just overnight became Greek culture. Everybody just embraced it as the, you know, kind of the cosmopolitan culture of the world. So Greek became a growing language. But for a while, the language of Turkey, Syria, of Palestine was Aramaic. That was the official language. So it wouldn't be unusual if people at Jesus' time to be trilingual. Anybody that had to deal with in matters of state probably dealt in Greek, the popular language of the people, and the more ancient or the earlier official language was that of Aramaic. And of course, some Jews still spoke Hebrew. Jesus, by the looks of things, spoke Aramaic. And maybe some of the Gospels were first written in Aramaic. Certainly, the Lord's Prayer was remembered in Aramaic and later translated into Greek. It wasn't long after that that Aramaic declined and Greek became the language. Hebrew, almost a forgotten language. And so, the translation of the Hebrew writings into Greek in the Septuagint became used not only in Egypt, but wherever Jews were. And so, and this was like 100 years before Jesus. The Sadducees liked Hellenistic culture. They would speak Greek and maybe even read the scriptures in Greek. There were also other translations. There was what's known as the Peshitta, and that's, I think it's the Syrian version of the Old Testament writings. Then there's Targums, which are Aramaic translations, and I'm sure there are others. And these are some fine old manuscripts that help people get back to what they feel are close to the original writings and the most ancient expression of the memory. This, of course, became dominant for Christians, and I'm going to draw a line right down here. And on the left side of the line is the Jewish sphere, and on the other side is the Christian sphere. You see the Septuagint span both of those.
Was the Septuagint from before or after Christ?
100 years before, as a result of the pressure. Christians took the Septuagint as their Bible. The writings came, and the first person to put together the writings, and they did, I think he did it in six parallel columns, much the same as this, the sixth version parallel. He wrote what was called the Hexapla, and each column had a different translation. I think one was probably Greek. There may have been some old ancient Hebrew in there. Put six different versions together, and this fellow was Origen, and I think he was from Egypt. And he used the Septuagint. It was called the Hexapla. Part of the reason that the Jews began to pull away from, this is your question, isn't it? To stop using the Septuagint was in response to Christian usage. There is a particular passage in Isaiah that the Hebrew says, "Behold, a young woman will conceive and bear a son, and the son shall be named Emmanuel." Was translated, just picked a sloppy translation. The Greek says that Parthenos, I think that's the word, a virgin shall conceive. And of course, Christians saw that and they said, aha, prophecy. And of course, one of the reactions that Jews would say would be to go back and look at the Hebrew and say, no, it says a young maiden, which could be a virgin, but not necessarily. And so there was a rejection early on as a reaction to Christian usage of the Septuagint as the Hebrew basis. Okay. The Greek writings, and this is the column for what continued the manuscripts in Greek and maybe for the archaeological discoveries. The same over here. What happened is that the popular versions of the scriptures existed pretty much independently of the earliest and most original sources. After Origen came Jerome, and I think he was like 5th century or 6th century. And Jerome, I have a picture of him here. See, Jerome. The Jerome Biblical Commentary is a Catholic commentary, and it's named after Jerome because of his place as the earliest biblical scholar. Is that how we are done? Jerome translated Origen's scriptures, Greek Septuagint, into Latin. Okay, so that the Septuagint became translated into Latin, and the Latin scriptures were born, and that was the same with the Greek was translated into Latin too. Then Jerome got the idea, well, he'd go back to the Holy Land and see how things were done there, and he went back and discovered, he's the first one to discover around, I think, the 6th century, he said, my goodness, I think the Old Testament was originally written in Hebrew. And of course, there was some disagreement about that. They felt that the Greek may have been the original. And so what happened was that he used some of the Hebrew writings to help him translate. And it caused the church all sorts of problems. He eventually produced a version of the Bible that became known as the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate. And the meaning of that is just the common Bible or the standard Bible. And what he did, he suggested, well, the Hebrews don't use the apocryphal books. They don't use the story of Bel and the dragon and the Susanna and that. They don't even use Esther. And so Jerome and his translator tried to throw the apocrypha out. And people like Augustine and other people began to have all sorts of, let's see, Jerome wouldn't have, if he's 6th century, I think, let me just erase the date, somewhere between the 3rd and the 6th century. Seems to me that Augustine was maybe a contemporary of Jerome. I can't remember. Anyway, the church got so upset that Jerome eventually put the apocryphal books back in. Okay? And that the Vulgate existed as a Bible and as the main Bible of the church, the Latin translation for the next 800 years, probably. Along about the time, there are 3 or 4 developments that all occur within 200 years of each other that began to affect this whole story. And one is the Reformation, the Renaissance, and the printing press. The Reformation began to look at some of the doctrines of the Catholic Church, the doctrines of purgatory and others, and the influence of some of the discoveries of the Holy Land, some of the freer travel, research into the biblical, and also the Masoretic text here. It began to have an influence on the Christian scriptures. And the Protestants began to take a more radical view of the Bible as they received it. Same thing was happening in the New Testament version. There were people beginning to look at all these manuscripts and start to compare them and say, whoa, they don't read the same everywhere. Erasmus was involved, was an opponent of Luther, and earlier people involved in writing, trying to get to a Greek text that they felt reflected the earliest writings, and that was called the received text or the textus receptus. And that became the basis for a lot of the New Testament writing. Okay? So that they would actually now start translating books from the Hebrew and from the Greek and maybe compare them to the Vulgate. So we have, all these different translations begin to happen. I'm going to put English translation here. German. Luther was the one that translated the Bible from Latin into German. We'll put French. I don't know who did that, but it'll be important for the later story of the English version. And just for simplicity's sake, we'll follow the English version down. Around 15, I think there was a fellow named Wycliffe in the 1300s, earlier than this, that first translated some of the Bible into English from the Vulgate. Not too long after that, in the 1530s, a fellow named William Tyndale translated the Bible into English. And he was vigorously opposed for doing it. One of the problems that was coming about was that the vision of the church was that the words were the word, and that the consideration of variant readings of the human kind of input that is involved in the story, as we've seen it all around the perimeter here, was eliminated from the thinking, and you had to have, you know, a standard edition, and that the words became sort of equivalent with the word. And when William Tyndale began to mess with that, the church was up in arms, and finally they burned him at the stake for translating the Bible into English. He's not the only one that happened to. There came very soon to have all sorts of questions about the text, the received text here. And they began to think that maybe that didn't reflect the original Greek languages. The English, meanwhile, are starting to write all these other versions, and they come out with like 6 or 7 or 8 in a 100-year or 200-year period, until finally, around 1590 or so, they decide, well, it's about time to bring all these, to finally make a definitive English translation. And what happened was in sometime around 1605 or something, James I asked England's biblical scholars and the theologians of the church to put together a version that he authorized, and it became known as the Authorized Version. And it was published, dedicated to King James, in 1611. And for like 250 years, it became sort of the Vulgate of the English-speaking people, and we still have vestiges of that people will refuse to call anything other than the King James the Bible because of this long history and the words. Somehow a very satisfactory translation or version that's existed for 250 years begins to take on more authority than was originally intended.
Yeah, one reason is that it's a very beautifully written translation, and it's probably the greatest stylistic influence on English and American writers, just as a literary influence, as an influence of style. I think that's not so much, you know, belief that this is the sacred word, but just because it was powerfully written.
It's a lot of the sacred word belief too.
Okay. Most of the scholars that I read and looking at this have said, yeah, it is the beautiful, the most beautiful poetic version ever. Even people that helped translate the RSV admit that. But there is that element that
no, it's good.
That's the Bible Jesus used.
Yeah.
No.
The English version that then Catholics grew up with before modern Bible scholarship, was that like an English translation of the Vulgate?
And actually the Authorized See, James was a Stuart, and was he a Protestant then?
No.
England was Protestant, and
I Catholics didn't have the King, didn't use the King James like.
Did they stay with Latin? Did they stay with Latin Bible?
They maybe did. It seems to me that it would seem likely that the Catholic Church, had, especially in liturgical usage, would continue Latin, because they were using Latin when I was a boy.
But they had a Bible. The translation was the Douay Bible.
The Douay? Mm-hmm. And it was in English? Mm-hmm. Okay.
How do you spell that?
I'm wondering if that maybe was like a direct translation from the Vulgate into English. I bet it was.
It could have been.
That would be my guess.
Okay. Right. For 250 years until, well, like, let's say around 1881, a new Bible was published, and it was the Revised Version. And of course, you can imagine the attendant outrage at replacing the King James. And it eventually came. Let's see. Is that I have? Charts there. To replace, at least in English usage, the King James versions as a study Bible and as a liturgical Bible. In 1901, there was an American edition that was sort of disagreed a little bit with the Revised Version, which was in English, produced in England. And this was the American Standard Version. Some of the variant readings were included in that. The Revised Version eventually in 1948 was revised again. And the Revised Standard Version, the RSV, came out in 1952. Okay. And I remember using in college what was called the New American Standard Version. You ever heard of NASB?
Still around.
Okay, and that I think was sometime in the 60s. In the meantime, scholarship over here is turning up more and more kind of ancient manuscripts and developing more and more rules about how to figure which are the most reliable. The same is happening in the New Testament side. And what are produced are critical editions. And I can pass around a couple of critical editions that are continually updated, and that's what we use at, what your pastors use at seminary. And it's not really one text. Greek New Testament. The text is here, but down below then are variant readings from all these different manuscripts. So what you have here, rather than having just one text, you have maybe, well, actually all the existing, you have the readings from all the existing manuscripts at the time. That you have hundreds of texts in here. And if you know how to read the troublesome codes at the bottom, I'll pass around, you can look at it. You can find it, do your own kind of biblical research here and determine which readings seem to be the most satisfactory. Let me go on here. In the 60s sometime, the Roman Catholics, which evidently were using a translation of the Vulgate, the Douay Bible, went and took a French Catholic Bible and translated it with the help of these critical editions, and they came out with the Jerusalem Bible. And I think the French title is something like that, Le Bible, Le Jérusalem, something like that.
When was that?
It was in the 60s sometime, I think.
Is this Greek?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the Hebrew Bible has the same similar markings. Then there was an attempt to escape the influence of this line here in an English translation. And again, in 1970, an English Bible was produced from the original language manuscripts, and that was the New English Bible. And it fairly successfully escaped the conventions of the authorized version that were passed on to the RSV. Then there are other translations and paraphrases that fit in here someplace.
I think we're going to have an inclusive language Bible after a while.
I think there's someone right now working on one. I forget who said that. Have you heard of the New International Version?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Does anyone know where it came from?
My understanding is that it was a consortium of biblical scholars, mostly out of the evangelical tradition. It's published by Zondervan, which is an evangelical publisher. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, one of the advantages, and maybe one of the confusions, is that now that we have critical editions that are continually updated and in Hebrew and Greek both, people feel fairly confident about translating their own, and any particular group of scholars has at their fingertips all the resources of hundreds of years of biblical research. And so, well, they were teaching us to do what they were part of our requirements at seminary were to do our own translations. One other thing that is, we didn't talk about it a little bit, but the invention of the printing press, you can see how it would change it changes the character of the outline a little bit here. But it also changed the nature of the transmission of the Bible, in that you could print hundreds and hundreds of copies in a matter of days, all identical. Whereas before, each copy had to be handwritten, either by listening to dictation or by copying it from another book. And the stories about the copyists are some of the funniest ones and some of the most entertaining stories that I've heard in this particular field. There's the story about, I think, translation or transmission of the text on the continent, where there would be a particular reader who would read a phrase, and there'd be 10, 12 monks sitting around in this cold monastery, dipping their quills or reeds in the ink and then writing what they heard. And of course, there are some words that spell different that sound the same. And oftentimes, an inattentive monk would be guilty of putting down the wrong word that sounds the same. There was a story of some monks who were from Ireland who over copy knew Latin, but their reader didn't know Irish. And so they would write little notes to each other on the side of the manuscript, you know, like, it's cold out today. What do you expect? It's winter. And of course, the inspector of the manuscripts wouldn't know Irish. And he said, what are you doing that for? And they said, well, it's just the Irish equivalent of the text. At least that's what people think. But, there are little inscriptions at the end that said, praise be to God, the book is finished. And I can't imagine how many months it would take to finish a manuscript like that. The printing press changed all of that, and it wasn't long after the invention of the press, I think in the early 1520s or 30s, that the first critical or the first Greek testament was published, and there was a proliferation of all these translations, and it became very unmanageable for the church. It was used to having one official Bible and very few copies, and all under kind of lock and key. All of a sudden, it was popularized that everybody could have it, and it's never been the same since then.
Another interesting kind of footnote. I think I know more about it. Check me. But when I was studying German in Austria, a German institute course, our teacher said that Martin Luther invented High German in translating the Bible. That is, when he translated the Bible into German, what you had were a lot of German dialects. There was no kind of German that everyone spoke and then the dialect. And so he pieced together a kind of common German language, or, you know, a language for the Bible, and that became what is today High German. That is, the literate standard German, in coexistence with which there's, of course, all the dialects. And that, too, was a great unifying factor in German culture.
Okay. That's similar to what you would say happened in the King James Version.
Oh, no, even more radical, because the King James Version is a more a literary, I mean, it's been a powerful force among writers.
Writers.
In what sense of style.
But this was actually just a secular cultural
Yeah, and it was, I mean, it gave the people a common language. I mean, Germany was, of course, fragmented into a lot of principalities, but at least after Luther, through the Bible, there was a common version of the German language.
Okay. A Bible, a particular text of the Bible, translated by Luther, distributed, mass distributed by the printing press, which had been invented just 50 years earlier, had the power of imposing a standardized culture and a language upon the people. Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
It just occurred to me one of the sad things is that the Living Bible is one of the most popular Bibles in America. It's completely outside of this tradition of scholarship. It's one man's opinion who really didn't know the text and just wrote his own opinions in, and now it's become one of the most popular Bibles in America.
Yeah, in each arrow, in each connection between, there's always the risk of anytime there's a translation, there's always a risk in popularizing and making it understandable of departing significantly from the original writings. And that's what Ken Taylor did, and he just paraphrased an English version. Or a couple English versions, and with no knowledge of the original languages, gave America its most popular. It's not even a version, which means translation, it's a paraphrase.
Or Good News for Modern Man.
Yeah. Does anyone know how that came about?
That's a translation. That is reliable. It isn't in the same class as the Living Bible.
Okay.
Although it takes a lot of liberty in making. And trying to make those.
But that was a group of people.
But it was, I mean, its background is scholarship of going back to the originals.
You can see maybe that translation is a difficult thing. I know the NASB, they tend almost to keep Greek word order, the New American Standard. And it's very difficult to read, but one of the advantages of it is you always know what, if you know Greek, you know what the Greek word is behind, because they use the same word in English. For the Greek every time they translate it, but it becomes very wooden. The RSV has adopted some of the principles of translation in this line of English translations, and so there's a sort of a compromise in that way. The Living Bible and the Jerusalem Bible are freer with their colloquialisms, and the Good News is very free, very contemporary English, but it's sort of a compromise between being faithful to the original language and communicating, you know, idioms and that from that language, and being real and breathing for American writers.
Also, there's, at least from a point of view of an English teacher or someone interested in language, there's a tension between the language of a text that conveys power and beauty and mystery, and that which is perfectly clear, relevant, easy to get a hold of. Mm-hmm. And my problem with the Good News for Modern Man is it is very clear. I have no doubt about that. It's clear as a bell. What's missing is all the resonance and richness and beauty that was, say, a part of the King James Version, for all its inaccuracy. This is not to defend, you know, in a kind of very conservative way, inaccurate translations simply because they're beautiful. But one problem in translation is that you make it very relevant, modern, hip, funky, whatever, you know. Oh, I see it. And what you lose is the sense of something more than the everyday.
Do we know if the original ones were written with a lot of style or great literature or something?
No. Well, first let me say, no, we don't have any originals. I mean, we don't have any that we know that Paul put the ink on the paper.
Right. I mean, I was wondering if literary style or something is really part of the tradition, or if that was something that came from the King James.
Scholars that I've read have said yes, that like the Gospel of Luke is written in very excellent Greek. The Gospel of Mark isn't. Mark is full of all these sometimes invented words, sometimes just real rude translations of Hebraisms or Aramaisms, you know, kind of just looked up one word at a time and stuck in the Greek word, and so they read like badly translated Hebrew. Luke, on the other hand, writes very well. And
also, I would say that if in fact the text about following, you know, your original point is not to convey this perfect replication of the Word of God, but to proclaim the gospel, then beauty and power of that proclamation, it seems to me, is extremely important. I would rather have a powerful and evocative translation than a dull, pedantic one. Partly, you know, it depends on how one views the function of the gospel. And I think, for example, one of the reasons Paul is such an influence is not only the practicalness of what he says, but that he is just simply one of a very great writer. You know, that would be hard to chime. He just wrote very beautifully, and that lends force to what he was saying. And this is just where I would say, whether or not the original, I mean, I would rather be Roman Catholic than Puritan on the matter of style and say that, yeah, if you can make it beautiful, go for it. What is the Masoretic text?
Okay, that's an interesting story. It's a little sideline.
And we have to talk about this column a little bit. Jews being displaced from Israel adopted the languages of the people around them, and Hebrew fell into pretty bad disuse. It also went through a transition in that the Hebrew alphabet around this time stopped being used, and they just kind of transliterated it into the Aramaic alphabet. And so what you had was a similar alphabet, but one that was maybe a little more readable and more polished was substituted, was just kind of used to express the Hebrew. And that's the familiar, the square Aramaic is what we see when we see the Hebrew word, you know. You know, this kind of style. That's the Aramaic alphabet. Okay. Well, Hebrew is a language that doesn't have any vowels in it. Okay. And so you get, and it reads from right to left. And so a sentence may look like this. Let's see. And of course, most languages were written without any kind of punctuation or space in between the words. And that continued like through the 4th or 5th century of the Common Era. So a sentence, if I have sort of an English equivalent. Would look like this. Well, you could probably make some sense out of it if you knew the context. The cat is on the mat. Or the cot is in the moat. You know, the context would probably tell you. And for a long time in the existence of the Hebrew text, relied on the context and the fact that it was that people knew it backwards and forwards. That the Jews, more than the Christians, were a people of the book, and that you began at a very early age memorizing, learning that. So that actually it served very well as a shorthand. There were traditions developed. The Mishnah is the oral tradition that interprets the law. The Talmud was another tradition. These two, at least in Jewish circles, became very important sort of subordinate scriptures for the people. And they were interpretations. The Talmud, I think, was a medieval interpretation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was an interpretation of all the cultic and cleanliness laws of the Old Testament. Well, what happened was that the people that understood and read this and were able to talk about it intelligently became fewer and fewer, and around 800 AD, it reached kind of crisis proportions, and a group of people in, I think, East Europe or Eastern Europe called the Masoretes, and I don't know what the word means, decided they were going to do something about it, and so that they invented. And of course, by this time, they regarded the text as sacred. You could not change these words here like that, or the order of them, or anything. So they invented a system by which they would aid pronunciation and understanding. And so what they did was they started doing this sort of thing.
Can you read it?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a little and if you look on in the Hebrew Bible, that's passing around there, you can see the little dots and dashes above the letters. What they are is vowels supplied by Masoretes, and they're called the Mazora. And what they are is they're supposed to enable you to help pronounce it and to teach it. They standardize the grammar too. And so they did a great function, first of all, for the Jews at the time, around the turn of the century, or in the turn of the millennium, established a very standard work. And one of the interesting things is when the Dead Sea Scrolls, Hebrew writings clear back here, were discovered, it was found that when they had a parallel, when the books paralleled the Masoretes, the texts were extraordinarily similar. Very few alterations in the text, you know, like you'd figure if you played the game telephone over centuries, you know, where you whisper something to the next person and they whisper it next and it comes around, very seldom is it recognizable. Over this 1,000 years, the text had changed very little. And so that's one of the significance of the Dead Sea Scroll discoveries. And so it was scholars immediately assumed, well, at this time, they were grateful. The impact of the Masoretic translations on the Jews is obvious, but it also had impact on the Reformation and the budding biblical scholarship of that time. One of the interesting, I've told this to a lot of different people, one of the interesting oddities of this was William Tyndale, the martyr translator, got a hold of this thing. And he found these letters here. You know, knew it was the name of God from the context, and found these letters. No, let's see. Found these letters with him. And so he translated it, and I think the Y and the J have been altered. The Y has been pronounced as a J. So taking the Masoretes, he got this word. Okay. Well, what the Masoretes have done is that sacred text, this word, as the word name of the word for God for this medieval piety, was unpronounceable. You couldn't say it. And so to protect that, they didn't put in the letters, the original. They didn't put what they figured was the original pronunciation. Maybe they, out of piety, had forgotten it. And so they put in the vowels for the substitute word, Adonai, which meant Lord. And so rather than what you got was the vowels from one word, and that the Masoretes, anytime they came across reading that, of course, the people they had instructed and all the Jews would know to say Adonai there. Tyndale didn't. He said Jehovah.
What letter is that underneath
the U and the H? I have an AI for these vowels here.
I heard when it was in Denver that some Jewish people are very upset now that some Christians are starting to say Yahweh in their liturgies. As unfortunately, we now have in our masses. You know, that's very offensive to Jewish people. They've never minded when we've written it, but now that some Christian groups are starting to say the word in their liturgies, it's very.
Yeah, so
like wakening a sleeping giant.
Because you're not supposed to speak the
name? Yeah, but throughout ages and ages and ages, the word was never said.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would throw another problem in the word. Inclusively.
It does.
It's something we should talk about.
Yeah. But how sensitive it should be to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason that the French translation of the Jerusalem Bible, the French have had no problem evidently using. But they didn't inherit from Tyndale the English mistake of Jehovah, and or the correction that eventually became the Lord. You know, now wherever this word occurs, we, like the Hebrews, use the equivalent of Lord or Adonai. We use the Lord, and in the RSV, it's in small capital letters rather than in the lowercase. I don't know where that piety began. There's, by the looks of things, the earliest memories of the Jews called on Yahweh by name.
I think we lose the beauty of the name, the meaning of the name, by not using it.
I am
Yahweh. You know, when I'd heard or read before about the translation of the Greek translation of young woman, Hebrew into Greek, and I must say that mistranslation has produced such, in my view, a monumental amount of theological and moral gobbledygook that it flattens the mind. Not simply about Mary, you know, the totally irrelevant Zen-gone question of immaculate conception.
When the RSV came out, there were public Bible burnings because that was young woman instead of virgin.
But even after then, the whole treatment of virginity in Christian culture. But I mean, it's just a kind of a non-issue that got made a central thing.
That seems to be one of the arguments of the importance of knowing about the descent of our English version, because one translator here, somebody's putting the word Parthenos in there instead of another equivalent word, has generated all the controversy that we have surrounding the virgin shall conceive and virgin and the medieval worship of Mary as virgin and virginity. And, one word. And although we can say that the church has had a fairly faithful, and given all the things that could have gone wrong, a fairly faithful translation for the 2,000 years of its existence. The fact that there are some people who are looking at the variant readings has been always a, well, at first for me it was a disturbing thing, but now it's a very comforting thing. Some poor biblical scholars wearing glasses as thick as Coke bottle bottoms, and has a foot, his life's work is summed up in a footnote in one of these texts, but it has been worthwhile work. There's one more story I wanted to tell you about the discovery of a manuscript over here, and it's I don't have all the details, but I can give you the gist of it. In the 4th century, the writing, most of the texts that we have before this time are just in little fragments, little pieces that lay on velvet at Harvard or University of Michigan, little tiny scraps that have 5 or 6 words on them. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, actual books and scrolls from before Jesus' time, was really a remarkable find. The books were written as scrolls. That's why Luke and Acts was probably split in half, because one fits on a 31-foot scroll, probably, and the other one fit on the other. And they're very uncomfortable to read. You know, to find your place, you had to unroll the whole scroll. They're difficult to store, and they're very expensive. They would cost like 4 years' wages to buy them. The kind of labor that it took to first make the paper or scrape the skins that went into it. Then the codex was invented somewhere around the 2nd century, which put books together in leaves, and that gave the added advantage that it was small, that you could print on both sides of the paper. And many times if the books were found no longer useful, they would even scrape the pages clean and print over the top of them something else. And they have found some of the manuscripts, the earliest manuscripts, have been found underneath some insignificant medieval theologian or early, who had scraped off the Bible of like the 3rd or 4th century and had then written his own little treatise over it, because the paper and stuff was so valuable. One fellow, Count von Tischendorf, who I think was a Russian biblical scholar, and in his seminary salad days, he was going around the Middle East, and he was kind of looking for manuscripts. He was into biblical study and looking at the Hebrew and the Greek. He found his way to the monastery of St. Catherine's down at the traditional site of Mount Sinai down in Negev. This little thing in this tortured country, and these monks had lived there for centuries and centuries. And, I spent a week with him or something, and talking about his work, and he showed the abbot a manuscript that he had found someplace, and the abbot says, "Well, I have a Greek Bible too." And he went to this room and took out this codex wrapped in red cloth and unwrapped it. And it was a Greek Bible from the 4th century, from like 300 AD, almost complete, the earliest, and of course, Tischendorf's reaction was, my God, what is this? And got permission from the abbot to stay up all night, copied as much as he could. He said it was a sacrilege to sleep with this in his hands. And then asked the abbot if he could borrow a ticket to Cairo, where he had some colleagues and could translate it. Well, the abbot got suspicious, took it back, wrapped it up in the cloth, and wouldn't talk to him anymore or let him see it any longer. He's just frantic. He, you know, kind of cased the monastery as well as he could, talked to the garbologist, who was evidently burning the trash in the basement or someplace, and in casual conversation with him, he said, well, we have many of these, but we've been using them to start fires for years. And it found a few pages, you know, that were equally valuable kind of manuscripts. Well, his money ran out. He went back to finish his studies, and always wanting to get back to the monastery of St. Catherine's. And finally, 10 years later, he was able to get some money for traveling from the Tsar, and took along a gift from the Tsar. And this was the late 1800s, I think, to take down to the monastery, and it gave this I think it was a brand new Russian version of a Greek Bible. And they accepted the abbot. The abbot asked what he could give to the Tsar. And of course, Tischendorf said, well, that codex, the book wrapped in the red cloth, and the abbot did give it finally. And Tischendorf took it back home to Moscow, and I think through the revolution or some other things, ended up in the British Museum, and that's called the Codex Sinaiticus. It is one of the most valuable of the early, it's probably the earliest complete Bible written in Greek that we have in existence. There are other stories about the discoveries like that, you know, the shepherd boy and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I could recommend to you the book by Bruce Metzger on the text of the New Testament, where he has a bunch of pithy little stories. Summary. Let's quit here. It's apparent from this that there is the word, when you say the Bible, you're talking about an abstraction. Okay? An abstraction from many Bibles. Because there is no the Bible. There are many, many Bibles. And they all have a history. They all are related to particular times and contexts, just like the original books were. The importance of the Bible, then, or the Bibles, is not tied too closely to the words on the page, but that somehow, through a little more complex and a process that requires more faith and maybe a little more study and hard work, the words become living word through our connection with the people who wrote them and struggled with the memory of God and God's treatment of God's people, and also from the influence of our present Christian community, and by means of those things, through God, by the Holy Spirit. Like I said, it's not a simple task to read and understand it. But it's not impossible. It's not really that laborious. I think it's fun and instructive. And I think it's by coming to kind of to understand the transmission of what we regard as the sacred writings, the holy book, it helps us to become participants in the struggle with our memory.